new episode of Dialects for the Common Good, I'm very happy to talk with Jakub Rowitz. Jakub Rowitz is a professor of social science at Warsaw School of Economics. How are you doing, Jakub?
Fine, thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Let me briefly introduce Jakub to our audience. Jakub is an economist, and he's working on economic growth, looking more specifically at issues related to production functions, determinants of growth, technological progress, productivity, R&D. And also in addition to that, Jakub, especially with his wife, works on the economics of social capital. He publishes widely in internationally recognized journals. I think Jakub worked for the Central Bank of Poland, and he's also clearly active in the policy debate, working and writing papers there. Jakub, you recently wrote a book that you, I believe, rightly so, called your magnus opus. It is entitled Accelerating Economic Growth, Lessons from 200,000 Years of Technological Progress and Human Development. You have sent me the book, and I read this. I read it in one go. I found this an amazing walk through our history of economic growth with an equally in-depth and thoughtful walk through our potential future as well.
Thanks very much for these very kind words.
So I think that's a book that definitely deserves wide attention and discussion, and I hope that in this Dialogues for the Common Good, we can go through a couple of main issues that the book addresses. Now, basically what you do is you discuss issues related to the history, but also to the future of economic growth. You discuss the ultimate goal of mankind, the decomposition of development, acceleration of growth, the establishment of data accounts, artificial intelligence, you redefine production functions. Well, there's simply so much depth in this book and new ideas. I believe it should be on the reading list of all economists. So definitely what we will do afterwards is try to figure out some ways how that can be done, yes?
You're going to help me advertise, I would be glad. I would be very, very grateful, yes.
Jakub, let's talk a bit about the content of the book and some takeaway lessons from this. Could you, for our readers, say a couple of words about the book's main message, please?
So the main message is about the history of the human civilization. And I ask questions, like fundamental questions. Why is it the case that humankind began as one of many species fighting for survival? And then there was a sequence of technological revolutions that enabled people to first conquer the world, then to move to towards an agrarian society and you know come up with various agricultural technologies, then to expand in terms of knowledge, then through the scientific revolution, then eventually go towards the Industrial Revolution, which was a game changer in terms of the standards of living for the whole humankind. And eventually now we are going through a digital revolution, which is yet another complete breakthrough that basically unpins data processing from the human brain. So, I mean, I think there were at least five major technological revolution in the human history, and going from one revolution to another, at each time growth, whatever you would like to measure the outcome, growth accelerated by orders of magnitude, and thinking about the future, it also tells you that it's probably problematic to just extrapolate trends from recent decades and believe that that's what was going to happen, because the long history teaches us that there were certain qualitative breakthroughs, and the overall trend for growth is accelerating. So that is what we can expect for the future, that growth would not stop, would rather accelerate because of technological changes, which we, of course, cannot fully predict at this point, but which have taken place in the history and are likely to take place in the future as well.
Who should read your book?
Excuse me?
Who should read your book?
Who should read? Okay. I think the audience for the book is not just economists. I'm an economist myself, so you can see this in the book. This approach and this perspective is probably dominant throughout the book, but it's not just a book for economists. I think it's for everyone who's interested in the story of the humankind, like in understanding what caused the humankind to get to where we got, to develop this amazing civilization.
Now we do know that basically there were several stages of development that have been classified, maybe not to a degree as you have or brought together. What would you say is particularly novel in your book?
I guess one of the main things is the distinction between hardware and software, or energy and information. So, if you look at the whole history of development, it seems crucial to distinguish between technologies for processing energy, for getting energy to perform physical actions, and then putting those sources of energy into productive use. That would be the hardware part. And the other thing is the software part, that is information processing, data processing, storage, and communication. So, like, if you look at the long history, you could actually organize these technological revolutions as a grand pendulum of economic development. So you had revolutions in hardware and you had revolutions in software. And so you had the cognitive revolution, which basically started the expansion of the Homo sapiens across the world. That was a change in a gradual change evolutionarily predicated that changed the way we could process data in our brains. So that was a software revolution. But then you had the agricultural revolution, which dramatically changed the access to food for the humankind, because we could learn to transform the ecosystems in our favor so that we could produce more units of energy per unit of land area. So that was a big revolution in the access to energy. So that's hardware. Then again, the next big revolution was in terms of software. That was the scientific revolution. Again, the scientific method, mathematizations, hypothesis testing, all of which was really strongly helped by this fantastic tool for disseminating knowledge, which is the printing press. That greatly helped process information and communicate information, spread information. Then the next big revolution was the Industrial Revolution, again in hardware, so in access to energy. So the biggest technologies of that era are the steam engine, the internal combustion engine, the electric engine. All of that is really about getting access to energy, in this case from fossil fuels mostly, and then to harness this energy and to put it into productive use. And then the versatility of the electric engine was fantastic. So that basically electricity generation could be completely split from the final use, very helpful. Again, a big revolution in terms of hardware. And then the fifth revolution that I have discussed in the book is the digital revolution, which is again the software revolution, a revolution in our capacity to process information. And this time, it's the first time in history, really. So only the last few decades are a time where information is to a large scale processed outside of the human brain. Also, the communication of information is mostly now done outside of the human brain, which never happened before in the history. I mean, with some minor exceptions, like you could basically train animals to do some things, but basically most of the time, really, it was about people thinking, people communicating, talking, and making decisions. And now this is to an increasing extent shifted towards digital machines. Yeah, so that would be the
You
breakthroughs.
argue that
That was a
the
bit the big idea, that this pendulum of development and hardware and software. Well, you also have to keep in mind that hardware and software are complementary. Yeah, so you need both for producing. You need to know what to do. So you need the code, the data, you need the information, but you also need to perform the physical action. So you need the energy as well. And so these two inputs are complementary. And this interplay between one and the other input is actually an important driving force that, drives the pendulum.
In your book, you suggest that the next pendulum swing should be a hardware revolution. And you argue that this next hardware revolution could make us redundant in a certain sense. In a sense that, for example, all jobs will be eventually automated.
Just a quick reply. I would say it's already the ongoing digital revolution that could make us redundant. It's really because in terms of processing energy and performing action, like our manual physical work is to a large degree redundant already. I mean, our value in the market, in the labor market, is mostly because of the cognitive work, right? Because of our capabilities to process information, make decisions, and so forth. And this is getting automated. And so it's already within this ongoing digital revolution that then this scenario can materialize, even before any possible future revolution in hardware.
And what would this imply for wealth creation or for inequality?
The trend itself, and the technological trend itself, without any policy whatsoever, is really towards extreme inequality. Because it seems that digital technologies are characterized by scalability, strongly increasing returns to scale, and software is easily accumulable in per capita terms. Like, one of the big reasons why during the 20th century, where we mechanized the physical action, but we didn't automate cognitive work, the main reason why this helped reduce inequality was that every person has one brain, right? We cannot accumulate more brains per capita. And so this is a natural way of dispersing the product. I mean, product and then returns to the product, right? Everyone has one brain and can and will get remuneration for the products of the brain. But now, when data is not processed in the human brain, but it's processed in, let's say, computers and then maybe big cloud servers and so on, there's a strong tendency to accumulate hardware, computer hardware, but also software, also data. The biggest companies of today are the GAFAM, right? This huge data, the huge tech companies that have control over big data sets. information about us all, and can reap the benefits from increasing returns to scale in the digital market in which they operate. So this in itself seems to be a powerful force of increasing inequality, especially as jobs are getting automated by machines whose ownership is concentrated, right? And that means a trend towards more and more inequality.
Does this observation basically support Piketty's thought that capital owners will get richer and richer and the rest will become poorer and poorer?
Well, if you frame it in this way, you could say it does support, although, like, I read Piketty's book as well, and I'm not in full agreement with his thesis, and I don't really think it's that capital versus labor distinction which is important here. I really think it's really this hardware versus software distinction, and also within software, it's the distinction between human cognitive work and automated processes. Okay, so this pre-programmed software and algorithms that do the cognitive work in place of humans, and so this is where we see the change at this point. Not really traditional capital, I mean, in the sense of, you know, owning land property or factories or things like that. Okay.
Talking about software, you are suggesting that we are in dire need of developing a kind of data accounting. What is your thought behind that?
Well, my thought behind that is that this data dimension is growing extremely fast. The volume of data worldwide is doubling every 2 to 3 years, so that's an order of magnitude faster than growth in global GDP, which doubles every 20 to 30 years. And then we have very little information about flows and volumes of this asset, which seems to be productive, which seems to benefit the companies that own that. And if you think about of a historical analogy, you could think about the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, where the policy that could be performed at that time was really about you know, measuring and taxing the production of food. So that was people knew how to do that, and it was practiced for centuries. Whereas in the beginning of the industrial era, the capital market was virtually unregulated because that was a completely new thing. People didn't know how to measure that. And it took a long time before we could devise something which we now take for granted, that is the GDP, the gross domestic product. I think it was eventually agreed upon in the 1950s. So on the system of national accounts that, I mean, that we use also today, maybe with some changes afterwards. So only then we got a handle on the creation of value added, you know, how to measure that, and then you can have a value added tax, and you have this policy which is well suited to the industrial era, and we are still running policy which is well suited to the industrial era, only that we are now entering the digital era, where we also have new inputs and new outputs, which we cannot really measure. A lot of output in the digital economy is provided to the market at essentially zero price. Like you log on to the internet and you have a lot of interesting goods and services for which you don't have to pay in money, in dollars. So it's, but in return, you provide your data, which can be helpful for the company, and we don't really know how to measure that. We don't know how much data is processed, is accumulated. We only know some basic aggregates, but that's maybe too little given the development of this industry at the time.
So what would you view as, let's say, the main obstacles for achieving a successful data accounting in the lines of national accounting?
I mean, the main problem is that it would have to be global because data transfer doesn't really see national boundaries. Like, if you transfer commodities, you know where they cross the border. When you transfer data, it's immediate. So also, there is an awful lot of redundancy. So data goes back forth again, many times, which is not productive. Also, some data is even, has negative productivity, even harmful in many cases. So, devising the system of national accounts wasn't an easy task. It took a long time to develop that. So I don't have a clear solution right now. But it seems to me like there is this very quickly developing area of economic activity about which we have relatively little information, a little understanding. It seems to me that we would sooner or later need to improve this understanding. That's
Yeah,
my thoughts.
I fully agree with that, definitely. You discussed a, let's say, new idea in terms of how humans basically choose, and you call this local control maximization. Could you maybe explain this concept that you developed briefly?
Yeah, great. So I was thinking in terms of this book about this fundamental question: is what is the cause for growth? What drives economic growth? And of course, it's an outcome of accumulated actions of millions and billions of people. But what drove those people to do these things that culminated in development of the civilization? It seems a fundamental question to ask. And actually dawned upon me when reading about something somewhat unrelated, that is, when reading about artificial intelligence, because they have this result called the not auxiliary, but instrumental convergence, right? Instrumental convergence. And it's has been originally formulated for artificial intelligence algorithms, but it really seems to fit any optimization entities. And in particular, if we think about people as individuals who do optimize something, who try to make best decisions, whatever that means. It seems like we can view ourselves as individuals who pursue some goals. And then if we do pursue some goals, then we are also subject to instrumental convergence. And instrumental convergence is a thesis that says that basically whatever your final goal is, you would also pursue four auxiliary instrumental goals. First is self-preservation. You would like to survive, you would like to multiply, so basically, you would like to survive into the future with the goal that you have, meaning you would also like to preserve the goal. So that's the first thing. Very, very basic drive to survive and to multiply, and to preserve the goal which we have, whatever that goal may be. The second thing is efficiency, technological perfection. So we have limited resources, and we would like to use them efficiently so that we can do as good as a job as we can in pursuing the goal we have. So that is this second drive. The third drive would be a creativity, or willingness to improve upon the ways of performing tasks that we have right now. So basically, we would like to devote some part of our resources, some part of our time, to some experimentation. So we would, instead of just doing the same job as we did in the past, which was relatively effective, but well, maybe there is a way to do it way more effectively. So we can devise part of the resources and time to thinking about better ways of doing what we do. And if we're successful, the costs, short-run costs will be outweighed by the long-run benefits. So that is this creativity drive. And then the fourth drive would be resource acquisition. So whatever you're trying to do, you would be better at it if you had more resources to use. So that is a drive for getting more and more and more resources. And it seems to me that like this description really fits what people have been doing for millennia. And we have been always trying to survive, to be effective at what we were doing, to basically do our job well. Then there was always some sort of experimentation or creativity going on, and eventually we really love to accumulate resources. I mean, it seems like a very fundamental drive as well. So if you take all four together, it's a set of four instrumental goals, and I just put a label on the union of all four. I call it local control maximization, which is an instrumental outcome from basically any final goal that you can think of. Not fully any, but a very big variety of final goals that you can think of. And I'm not saying that local control maximization is what we are fundamentally going after, but I'm saying that maybe there is something else. But whatever that something else would be, from that we would also follow local control maximization. So whether we like it or not, we do it. That's the idea, and that seems to be the emergent drive that underlies this development of the civilization and economic growth and technological development, all that.
In order to understand the reasons for our development, you also discussed that one needs to know the goals, right? Why do we basically do what we do? And in one part of your book, you discuss that you believe that the instrumental goals are aligned with the true human purpose. Why do you believe that is the case?
The true human purpose. I mean, I'm not sure if there exists one. Okay, so first of all, you have to keep in mind that our goals may be not always the same. So in the cross section of people, we may have different goals. There may be statistical noise. There may be changes over time. So maybe in one generation, the goal would somewhat differ to the goals of the next generation. But the beauty of this emergent local control maximization thing is that really those instrumental goals follow from a wide variety of true goals that you can think of. So the intriguing thought that I had, and which I put in the book, is that maybe to understand development of the civilization, maybe the true final goal is really irrelevant. Maybe we would get to where we are from a variety of true final goals. Maybe there is no unified, generally applicable final goal. Maybe there is a variety of goals, but in any case, from all of them, typically you would have instrumental convergence, and therefore you would have local control maximization.
In effect, when you discuss local control maximization, and this may be more interesting for economists directly, this reminded me very much of utility maximization subject to bounded rationality. Is there anything I'm missing, or?
I mean, are you asking if that's the same, basically?
Yeah, if I could, if I'm, when I'm thinking as a simple economist, and if I'm thinking about local control maximization in terms of utility maximization subject to bounded rationalities, that correct, or am I still missing something?
I think you could formalize local control maximization as utility maximization, although it's not certain what kind of arguments would go into the utility function, it seems. Not because, you know, this claim is relatively general, whereas if you think about economic models, you typically assume that, you know, utility is derived from consumption, or maybe consumption leisure, maybe consumption leisure and, you know, human capital of the children, or there are many variants, but there is like always a closed list which is assumed in the beginning. I'm not sure if, I mean for practical reasons, like in practical applications, I guess you could formalize it like this, but I think that would kind of blur the background. I'm quite happy about the idea of using this instrumental convergence thesis in this regard, because it seems to me that you know, it's a general it's a general premise from which I start to get something specific. So it seems very, very nice, a very nice thing. It's always a fun thing to see some very specific conclusion derived from a general set of assumptions. Like, I guess one of the most beautiful theorems is the central limit theorem. Like, you have a variety of distributions, things can be distributed in various ways, but if you have a process that you aggregate, so you have a sum of variables that have those distributions, that under very general assumptions you converge to a normal distribution, which is very specific and parsimonious. So it seems to be something like that. So from a huge variety of possible goals, which with a variety of possible variables which you can put in, actually you would still converge to this local control maximization, which is relatively specific and parsimonious.
Yeah, I like that analogy to the central limit theorem. Let's take this a step further. When you talked about the instrumental convergence, you basically applied it also to artificial intelligence.
And that's where it comes from.
That's okay.
Omohundro and Bostrom are the authors, and they're working extensively on AI.
In your book, you develop, or you devoted a lot of space and thought to artificial intelligence.
Yes.
What is your thought about our future when it comes to AI?
That's, I think, the force that will determine the future, really. If you think about the developments of the digital era, it seems like we have ongoing progress in automation and replacing people's cognitive work with data processing on machines like computers or smartphones or whatever. And so the thing is, though, that so far we only have narrow applications of automation technology. So we can automate very specific things, especially routine jobs, which are easy to codify, very repetitive. We can automate that. But if there is a complex task which is in an uncertain environment and has a lot of subsequent steps to be taken, that is hard to automate. And that's where people's skills so far have been most needed, okay, where they seem essential and they probably will stay essential for a while. So it seems to me that there is a big leap in productivity of a process when you fully automate the process. So if you have a process that has a few steps and you automate like 4 out of 5, then you still have the person, the human, who performs the fifth last step, and the productivity of the whole process is really determined by the productivity of the human who does the last step, which cannot be automated. So that is partial automation. But if you can fully automate the process, then you can actually accelerate the whole process by orders of magnitude. So it seems that there is a big increase in productivity when you fully automate processes. And then quite the question is, how would you possibly fully automate complex processes that we see in the world today? And the answer is actually, you know, with simple algorithms, you cannot do that because it's too complicated, too uncertain. You really need something which is increasingly able to live in this reality and to make good decisions. And that leads towards artificial intelligence, towards algorithms that can learn, that can improve their performance based on data, and they can that can potentially address a number of tasks at the same time, a number of tasks. And it seems to me that, well, we clearly see the trend that both the capacity and also the generality of application of AI is increasing over time. And that is what would be most important for increasing the productivity of software in the digital era. So to me, it seems like the key change that we would fully reap the benefits of the accumulated hardware is more and more advanced, more and more general artificial intelligence. And so whether this trend is going to continue is what would really determine the future of the civilization of the humankind in the digital age.
In the book, you talked about the artificial intelligence that is a paperclip maximizer.
Yes.
What is your biggest worry when it comes to artificial intelligence?
Yes. So in the case you haven't heard about the paperclip maximizer, it's a very brilliant idea by Nick Bostrom. By the way, I love the book Superintelligence by Nick Bostrom. So, well, it's a doomsday scenario, basically. So it's about creating a super intelligence that is an algorithm that would be more intelligent than people are. And also, given the fact that AI algorithms can learn, can improve their performance, possibly also in the future, they could rewrite their code to further improve their performance. So that could lead to a self-sustaining feedback loop and what is called an intelligence explosion. And so then the biggest question of all is what would be the goal of that AI which undergoes intelligence explosion? Because once it goes and intelligence explosion becomes more more productive, you know, because it becomes more intelligent than people, there will be basically no way back because there will be no way to switch it off. It would be clever enough to understand that switching it off would compromise its goal, and it would not let compromise its goal. So it would, you know, the first drive, self-preservation, preserving goal content would really make it unable for us to switch it off, to destroy, to reprogram. Okay, that would be impossible. And then if the goal is not perfectly aligned with the well-being of the humankind, we will be most likely dead. That's the bottom line of this problem. That's a existential threat to the humankind. Now, it's maybe a promise of of further development of the civilization, which would still undergo further technological revolutions and process information even faster, get even more access to energy, be more efficient at all tasks. Maybe it is a future like that, but it may be also a future without people. Why? Because if the goal, even in the slightest degree, is not consistent with our well-being, with our existence whatsoever, then we would not have the resources to stop the process of us being exterminated. And so that's the biggest worry. And that's very nicely illustrated by this paperclip maximizer example. So it was about an AI company that, you know, works on a new algorithm that seems promising. It seems like a very nice idea that we have right now. Let's see how it works. Okay, let's program it to something simple so we can have an easy metric of performance. Let it create the most effective way to produce paperclips. We know what a paperclip is. We know how to measure performance, so it's a great idea. Then plug it to the internet and basically go to sleep. And then in the morning, it's already too late because it accumulated all the information from the internet and improved its performance by orders of magnitude, understood how to, that it has this goal that has been programmed into it, and then reprogramming the goal would be harmful towards the goal. So also switching it off or destroying the computer or reprogramming that would be harmful for the goal. And so then the biggest threat to producing paperclips is the humankind, which should be then exterminated because of the need to maintain the goal. And then basically the whole universe around us would be changed into paperclips, right? Because you know, there is also another important thesis, which is the orthogonality thesis, which tells you that you can apply any level of intelligence to any goal, right? So it's not like the AI would gain consciousness and think, well, actually, paper clips are not a good idea. Let's do something else instead. It's not the case because it's a program which is explicitly pursuing the goal of paperclip production and maybe perfecting the way of doing that. So, So the point here is that it's really the intelligence level. It's really the ability to process information that is key. It's not really a question of like in Terminator movies or things like that you really you have this machine that gains consciousness and turns rogue against people. It's completely not about that. It's really only about the optimization power. That's all which is needed. And then if the power is really biggest in the whole world, then all the entities whose power is less, their fate is really determined by that entity whose power is greater. Like if you think about what people do to all nature, animals, plants, well, basically we do what suits us. We transform ecosystems. Many we drive. We drive species to extinction. We do a lot of actions that are clearly not aligned with the well-being of any given species. So, and we don't really do that because we hate this hedgehog. Or maybe we even find it nice, but it's an entity which is instrumental to us only, right? It's not really a part of our local control maximization routine. Okay, it's not a specified part of our goal. Yeah? So that's what seems to be most worrying about the potential development of artificial general intelligence, which would possibly overtake people in terms of optimization power. One more thing is that we will probably just have one shot. Okay, is one. There's no way to do trial and error because throughout the history, always all the developers were really through trial and error. There were some prototypes which didn't quite work, some better prototypes which kind of worked but not really, and so forth. Gradually, each idea was perfected to a level of something very good and productive and helpful. But in this case, like if we were to think about the final goal for the AI and we would go by trial and error, well, the first wrong try would be the last one. Right? That's the worry, which is really, really, a really big one that I have. I mean,
it's not yeah, really I agree. That's a big, important takeaway point, and I think it's really useful that you emphasize this. But despite all this, Voris, that you just came up with, you call yourself an anxious optimist in your book.
Yes, so that spoke about the anxiety.
Okay, but let's let me quote then from what you said. You said that you're an anxious optimist, someone who worries not that development will stop, but that development will be so great that it will spin out of control and accidentally hurt us. Now, this applies to, I guess, the AI scenario that you just alluded to. But how do problems such as climate change, species extinction, or biodiversity loss fit in that worldview?
Well, one thing to think about is the time frame. So if we believe that it is really possible that superintelligence will be created within, let's say, 50 or years or maybe 100, well, then maybe this worry is more imminent and more important therefore. But of course, at the same time, there is many unwanted consequences of the growth process that we've seen. And indeed, like for millennia, various species have been driven to extinction, and then ecosystems will be completely reshaped to serve the needs of basically producing food for people. And then, of course, after the Industrial Revolution, there is this, for instance, increase in production of greenhouse gases, which leads to global warming, which was clearly unintended when people developed the steam engine or the internal combustion engine or the electric engine, but which has indeed followed from this very development. So, indeed, these processes are already going on. There has been a discussion that the temperature is already 1 degree above the pre-industrial time, maybe even more, 1.2 or something. And it's, of course, going to increase over decades. And it depends a lot on our actions, how much it will grow. By the way, we are a species that evolved to fit best the ecosystem of a savanna in Neolithic or Paleolithic East Africa. So maybe for this reason our preferred temperature is like 20 something degrees, and so on. But also it gives our species biological limits. Like we cannot really survive in too hot an atmosphere. Like there are already heat waves, especially in India and that region of the world, where many people just die because of heat, because of not being able to survive in this heat. So this is already happening, and with this global warming, this will be even more frequent and so more deadly. So this is clearly a big risk that which is already going on, which is probably a bit more predictable, but not quite, because there are also these feedback mechanisms where we don't quite know what would happen once the permafrost thaws, once the ice sheets again thaw. So we don't know. Yeah, but we know this is an important issue to discuss. I don't know if that addresses your question or I went too far.
No, I think this is also the answer that you gave in the book. The overall question is still whether, let's say, you believe that growth will continue despite all the biodiversity loss that we are facing, despite all the climatic changes, the ecosystem losses, or whether that is likely to be a big impact on our development that we need to deal with in the near future.
I think that there is still some margin. So I think that growth will continue despite all these things you just mentioned. And also technical change will continue despite all the things that you've just mentioned. So it seems to me that we're not yet at a point where like ecological consequences of our actions would be, a threat to growth. Like physically speaking, okay, we may like consciously make a decision to slow down growth in order to take care of other goals. Okay, that is a possibility, though, looking at our ability to coordinate on difficult goals. It seems unlikely, unfortunately. I mean, there's a lot of action in terms of, switching to renewable energy and in Europe, for example. But typically it is like if you really want to counteract the side effects, it's typically too little and too late. So that's my expectation, that growth would be high on the agenda because of resource acquisition, because of the drives to have control, more and more control. It seems to me that I would expect growth to continue at the global scale, and also the side effects to mount the global scale, despite all the actions to mitigate that. That's my, well, maybe not at fully at the rate that would have been in the case of completely no action, but the action that there is, I guess, will be insufficient to completely stop these side effects, only slow down a little. That's what I think.
Jakub, we have now a very brief tour of your book and some slightly deeper discussions, but of course we could have much, much more on this. There are definitely things that we did not talk about, for example, related to the decomposition of growth that you suggest, which is also very interesting and quite subtle indeed. But at this point, I think our time has run out, and I would like to sincerely thank you for these insights, for having written this wonderful book.
Thank you,
And I can
Alex.
only suggest everybody else to take a deep look and well, and take as much away from the book as is possible.
This is the book.
Thank you, Jakub. It was a sincere pleasure.
The same with me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
Take care.